This is Richard Olyate, and I'm here at the residence of Mr. Joseph Eskenazi, and this is part of the Veterans Oral History Project, and we're here in Torrance, California, and the date is July 15th, 2012. Hello, Joseph. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And thanks for sharing your experiences with us.
Okay.
So if you could just briefly tell me, before you entered the Army, where were you living? What were you doing?
Okay, I was born in New York. My mother's name was Belina Eskenazi. She was married, but then she was divorced, and my father died when I was only 5 years old. So she went from New York to where her rest of her family lived at the time in Mexico City. And after being there a year or so, she decided to go back to the States because her brother was there. And so she put me in a summer school for a while because she had to go out and work to make a living. And I was very, you know, and that was a very traumatic experience for me to be without my mother. So then she realized she'd better get her children together. There were three of us, and go back to Mexico with her family. And I was raised in Mexico. I went to an American school. I didn't forget my English, but I still kept my Spanish, so I'm a bilingual. And from there, when I finished school, I went to high school for a year and a half. And then I decided that my mother needed help and I better go out and do some work. So I worked for an uncle at a lighting fixture company, and they did all kinds of ornamental iron work, and I learned the trades, doing shop work and also doing drafting and designing lighting fixtures and so on. And then when in the meantime, I did go to school, and I got a degree in surveying. And at first I wanted to be an architect, then I realized that it was better for me economically to become an engineer, because you could start earning more money that way. And then I, at the age of 18, I decided to go to the States because my mother loved the U.S. and she always talked about what a wonderful country this was, and I had the love. She passed that love on to me, and I wanted to be a member of the service, and that's why I enlisted. I enlisted in January 5th of 1940. And I knew there was a war on, and I was going to be there for the duration. So I happened to talk to a lieutenant colonel, I think he was, a nice old gentleman that said he knew just the right place for me to use my skills, my experience as a surveyor. So they took me over. They shipped me by train to Oceanside. That's where the headquarters was, in Oceanside. And I was very happy to work there and do a lot of this. It was just the sort of work I wanted to do, that I dreamed of. That was my ambition. And consequently, we would go up the mountains all over Southern California to turn angles, vertical and horizontal control. So we would send that information to Portland, Oregon, where they did the maps. So we were a field company for that sort of work. Mm-hmm. And later on, I think I was there about a year and a half, and I just loved my work there. But unfortunately, they put me in a cadre and sent me to Hawaii aboard the President Pierce. That was the name of the ship. I don't exactly know in what month it was, but it was around August, or either July or August, that I was shipped there. There was, at first we didn't have anything but cots to sleep in out in the open, and there was mosquitoes all over the place, and we spent the first two days without any nets or anything to protect us. Finally, they gave us the nets, and then we started building our own barracks. We got through building our barracks, and then by that time, I think it was getting close to December, and one of my buddies decided while we were up there nailing shingles on top of the roofs, he said he wanted to transfer to the Air Force and become a bombardier. And he asked me if I wanted to join him, and I said, no, I think I'll be here for a while, maybe later on. And that was my friend Lango, which got shot during the attack. They took pictures when the men were coming out of the mess hall, and they were being strafed, and Lango went down with four bullets across his chest. And we were very sorry that we lost one of our boys. And then on December 7th, we were sleeping, and it was a beautiful morning. It was December 7th, and all of a sudden we hear these loud noises, and we wonder what's going on. But in the meantime, we had heard from servicemen that by orders of FDR that he had relieved Admiral Richardson, James Richardson, from his command because he stated that we didn't have the adequate facilities to protect our Navy that was all bottled up at Pearl Harbor. And by the time they attacked us, I was very concerned because I wondered why we weren't on a Class A alert instead of a Class B alert, in which all we had to do was look out for saboteurs, and all the aircraft was lined up in rows, and they had the servicemen patrolling around to protect them from saboteurs. And I thought that was very foolish at that time, because I think we were at the brink of war from the news that we received. We got the news, we could hear it on the radio, and we were very concerned about that. We all wondered why we were not in a Class A alert. And one day before the attack, a friend of mine, a Swedish boy called Carlson, he asked me if I wanted to go with a jeep to a new facility. He says, I have to take mail there. They're putting up something called radar that we didn't even know what radar was at that time. Mm-hmm. So I went up there with Carlson, and there were two technicians working on their instruments, and we asked them what they were doing, and they explained to them that they were bleeps, that anything that was out within, I don't know, 50 miles or so, they could see, and for the purpose of protecting us from an attack. and or to see if there's any aircraft coming in or whatever. But it was mainly for the protection of the island, the patrol. They had aircraft that patrolled once or twice a day. And then after that, we heard on December 7th, we heard these tremendous noises, and we went out to see because we were within sight, visual range of Pearl Harbor at Schofield Barracks, and we could see these planes with the red circles under their wings. We realized that we were being attacked by Japan right then. And I could see some of these Nakajimas, I think they call them, that would drop torpedoes. And I saw one torpedo hitting one of the buildings, and that's the one that hit the mess hall where we lost about 300 boys there. They made mincemeat out of them. Wonderful young people in the prime of their life. It was very shocking. And then we got the call to arms by our captain, Captain Tibbs. He had us fall in, stand at attention, and he says, "We're going to Pearl Harbor right now to see what we can do to help the runways. They need us to clear the runway because they bombed a lot of our B-17s there." So on the way down there, we went through Wheeler Field. That's where they had all the P-40s, and we saw the destruction of all those airplanes that were stacked up in neat, very neat rows. And I said, "Oh my God, that they really hit us hard there because they didn't leave any of them." We continued on to Pearl Harbor, and by then we saw the devastation there was at Hickam Field. Actually, we went to Hickam Field, which is right next to Pearl Harbor, and they had bombed every one of those buildings, except two of them that didn't have any airplanes in them, but they even hit the one that where the shops were. And they were completely destroyed. And so when we arrived there, they asked for volunteers to go across the field, and bulldozers or lawnmowers or whatever, so we could clear the field from the wreckage. So I volunteered. Although, you know, as an old army man, they used to tell them never to volunteer, but at that time we wanted to volunteer. We wanted to do anything to help the situation we had out there, where we were being attacked. And on the way over, I looked at my watch. It was around 10 o'clock in the morning. The attack, I believe, when we were in bed, was there was about 8 o'clock, and they went over the Coley Pass, and they attacked Pearl Harbor. And when I got halfway to where the hangars were, where the runway was, actually, I looked to my right, and I saw a dot in the sky, and I started pulling my rifle, my M1 rifle, trying to take a shot at it because I knew it was going to come right over me. And before I knew it, I was just getting my rifle out, and he already had passed me, and he strafed me. I saw the dirt kicking up a few feet ahead of my bulldozer. And I said, "Oh my God, that guy really has good aim, because, you know, to be up in the air and flying at that speed, it was quite a feat. And then I went back. I went to the runway and started clearing up some of the wreckage. And then we were told to go in the buildings that were destroyed and make tie some kind of a knot that would hold up. It wouldn't slide or slip, which they call a bowline. And they made us climb up to the top about 80 feet above the ground floor and walk along the beams, and that's what we did. And then during that day when we were being attacked, and then at night we were on the alert, and we had our we heard the anti-aircraft batteries going all over the place and the searchlights flashing all over the skies, and a lot of this stuff was coming back down on us, and good thing we had some helmets to protect us, because a lot of this the shrapnel that fell back on us, it was pretty bad. And then our mission was to repair the railroad tracks, because they wanted to bring the 16-inch guns for the protection. They were being transferred from, I don't know where they were, these guns were, but they were going to go through there, and we had to repair the railroad. The railroads were just like pieces of steel, all curled up like spaghetti, and we had to cut them with a torch and put in new rails and fixed it up so that the guns could go through there the next morning. And that was part of the defense of the island, because we didn't know if they were going to be attacked again. We thought they would attack us. And then we were all night on the alert. We hardly slept that night. The next day we were asked to make dig foxholes all over the place. And later on we all wondered, well, apparently they're not going to attack us. But we had no idea what was going to happen next. All we knew is what we hear about the Philippines and the Corregidor, and that's where the Japanese were attacking us. And finally we started feeling like we were not going to be attacked. But that was quite an experience we had on December 7th. The day of infamy, as our president called it. I don't know what else to tell you about it, but after that I was shipped to an island which was another stepping stone toward Japan, and it was called Christmas Island, and we arrived there on Christmas Day on the banana boat that was called the Haleakala, and everybody got sick on board that little boat. But we were being escorted part of the way, and then when we got close to the island, which was about 1,200 miles south of Hawaii, about a degree off the equator, and there was a group of islands they called Line Islands, and Canton was one of them, where the submarines would be recharged or refueled. And our mission was to build a runway there. And we built it with what they call steel mat, which is a rug made out of steel that could be assembled very easily. They had interlocking pieces on them, and they could be handled quite easily. They were brought on trucks, stacked up in sections that were about, I would say, 20 or 30 feet long and about 6 feet wide. And we put those together in a hurry. We could put a runway together in no time. While I was in Hawaii, I also worked on a dummy airfield where we'd make dummy bunkers and we'd camouflage them and with nets and with different colors. So they wouldn't, we didn't feel that they would be that effective in case an airplane went by there and attacked us, but it would slow them down because they were looking for aircraft and they wanted to bomb something that would be worthwhile bombing. But the camouflage thing was just something to give us a little more time, and we built this runway at Kahuku Air Base. And the trouble is that place was under sea level, below sea level, and they could not land any large aircraft. They could only land fighter planes because they would sink. And no matter how many times we put coral, we build it up with coral, which is a very hard material. And eventually, if you put any weight on it, the water would seep right through it. And then the engineers, the officers that were in charge to solve the problem, they put pumps to pump that water out back into the ocean, but that didn't do it. That didn't work either because we were below sea level. So eventually they realized there wasn't much they could do except it would hold up lighter aircraft. So those are things that I remember. You know, I'm 94 years old, and a lot of things are very clear in my mind, but there's so much more to it that I don't remember.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and okay. Let's just break for just a moment and come back.